Then we can move from here to the spontaneous past life memories in adults. Again, those are situations where people would have these past life memories, these karmic patterns, emerging spontaneously in the middle of their everyday life. This happens most frequently as part of a kind of a spiritual emergency. This would be a spontaneously emerging, non-ordinary state of consciousness. But there exist various degrees of these past life rememberings that can happen even in the ordinary state of consciousness. A person, for example, comes to a certain location in a foreign country and suddenly feels this tremendous familiarity, kind of a déjà vu feeling, and is actually capable of knowing where they are going. For example, if they're moving, they know what's going to happen around the corner and so on. I describe an experience of my own in the book The Holotropic Mind, where I was visiting Pechorskaya Lavra, which is a monastery in Kiev with catacombs, and during my first visit there, I knew exactly what was coming next when I was moving through these catacombs. And then at a later date, I experienced a past life as a Russian monk who spent good part of his life in that monastery. And then we have the situations where past life experiences would be evoked by some powerful mind-altering techniques, which could be some systematic spiritual practice, which could be hypnosis, it could be psychedelic sessions of some powerful experiential psychotherapy like holotropic breathwork, or rebirthing, and in some instances even as a result of some powerful body work. So if we now look at these experiences, we'll find out that the person in a non-ordinary state of consciousness is suddenly kind of catapulted into another century, into another culture, is having some powerful experience, usually of a situation that's highly emotionally charged. Most frequently it seems to be negative emotions, aggression, fear, jealousy, and so on. But in some instances it could be very positive emotions, where there is a sense of a love affair, a situation of having an experience with a soulmate, experience of spiritual partnership, and so on. The other important aspect of these past life experiences is that the person has a very convinced sense of personal remembering. They're not just having that experience, but they feel this is not the first time it's happening to them. They once were that person and they had this experience in one of their previous lifetimes. There's also typically a connection between the past life situation and the present life situation. For example, I've seen in many instances that that person's present emotional and psychosomatic problems like asthma or some psychosomatic pains and so on would be meaningfully related to this past life experience, and when the person was able to complete that experience, it would have a healing result. These symptoms would actually disappear, they would be resolved. Very typically, people also get access to new information, sometimes quite specific, quite detailed, about the historical period in which this experience is happening, about the culture, about the architecture, the costumes, the weapons, the rituals, and so on, and in some instances even specifics about historical events. I described in my books two very powerful instances of experiences where there were certain historical details that we could actually verify. One of those experiences was from the war between England and Spain at the time of Walter Raleigh, where this person experienced himself as a priest who was with a group of Spanish soldiers besieged in a fortress in Ireland by the British army. And there was a negotiation that was actually conducted by Walter Raleigh, according to which the Spanish soldiers were promised free egress from the fortress if they opened the gate. And of course, when they opened the gate, they all got slaughtered. And in one of the sessions, this man had the experience of being the priest, and he saw a seal ring with initials on his hand and actually drew it. And then later, through some research in the archives, was able to find out that not only did this event happen, but that these soldiers had a priest with them, and that gave the name of the priest, and the initials of the name matched exactly the initials on the ring that he had drawn. Now, the interesting question that emerges here, of course, is this a proof for reincarnation? Is this a proof that we have lived before? And we have to say no at this point. While all these observations and findings are very real, it doesn't necessarily follow from them that we go from one lifetime into another as a separate unit of consciousness. There's continuity of the same unit of consciousness. There are other ways of interpreting it. So when we give the interpretation, it's basically like formulating a theory that would explain these phenomena. And there's always more than one theory that can explain certain phenomena. Like we have a situation in everyday life where objects are falling, and this is effect of observation. And at the same time, throughout centuries, scientists offered many different theories and explanations why it is, what does it mean that the objects are falling. In the Hindu tradition itself, for example, the belief in literal reincarnation of the same unit of consciousness is seen as a very low level, kind of a primitive interpretation of these observations. The full Hindu doctrine suggests that there is ultimately only one entity that ever reincarnates, which is Brahma. As long as we have a story about the world which has more than one protagonist, we are still under the influence of Maya, and we have to continue sort of our spiritual search. So while these experiences and observations are very real, there are certainly possibilities of some other interpretations of what this is about. It is part of the Tibetan Vajrayana tradition that certain high lamas are capable to maintain somehow consciousness throughout the bardos into the next lifetime. That it's also possible for some of these high lamas to predict exactly where they are going to be born, under what circumstances. And the other side of it is that in the case of the high lamas, the Dalai Lama and the Tulkus, when one of these people dies, then typically in the monastery where they had lived, the monks would start getting visions during their meditations, and they would start having dreams and so on, which would be pointing somehow to the place and the child where this being incarnates. And then after a while, all the information gets together and becomes sufficiently specific that it's possible to actually create a procession and then go and locate the child, take it to the monastery. And then the child is subjected to a series of tests where he has to choose from a series of objects the one that belonged to the deceased. And only if the child is capable of doing it, the child would be accepted as a reincarnation of the Lama or the Tulku. Then we have the next group of experiences and observations that have something to do with apparitions of the deceased person and communication with them. I mentioned already before that these experiences of apparitions happen frequently at the time of the death of certain persons. And we talked about the statistical accumulation within the 12 hours of the death of these persons. But they can also happen at any time. It can happen to people, for example, in psychedelic sessions where they encounter suddenly their dead relatives. Or it can happen in experiential psychotherapy. It can happen in meditation. It's very important to evaluate these experiences carefully. Now, just the fact that we have the experience of our dead grandmother in and of itself is not a proof of survival of consciousness after death or existence of some kind of astral realms inhabited by discarnate entities. There has to be much more than that. For example, there have to be some specific characteristics of that experience, or there has to be some very special information that comes through before we could take these kinds of experiences seriously. So again, we find frequently in the literature very interesting instances of that kind. For example, it would be a situation where somebody has an apparition of a person who he or she didn't know, but gives the description that can be later identified through photographs and verbal descriptions. Another situation is that some apparitions can be witnessed collectively by a whole group of people who then have consensual validation, or situations where apparitions happen serially to certain people. Again, of particular interest would be those cases where the deceased would have some kind of specific distinguishing characteristics, bodily marks and so on, that the percipient doesn't know anything about. And of course, the most interesting cases are those where some absolutely new information comes through that the percipient couldn't possibly have. So I will just mention a few of these kinds of observations of my own. The first of these was a situation where I was treating a patient who was very seriously depressed and also came into treatment because of his homosexuality that led him to about 6 suicidal attempts and attempt at castration by estrogens. And he was undergoing psychedelic therapy in repeated sessions. And in one of these sessions, he suddenly had an experience of an astral realm that was kind of filled with something like fluorescent ether. And in this fluorescent ether, there were points of consciousness which he recognized were discarnate entities, and they were trying to communicate to him somewhat desperately. He kind of compared the situation to the situation of Odysseus in the underworld, where these shadows, you know, were demanding and they wanted something from him. So they were sending him messages and asking for things. And I happened to write down one of these messages, which was a message from a young man who called himself Ladislav. And he asked my patient to give a message to his parents in a Moravian city. It gave the name of the city. And the message was that they shouldn't worry, that their son, Ladislav, was well taken care of. It also gave the telephone number of these parents. So when the session was over, I was sitting there with the telephone number, deciding what to do, and finally I dialed the number. And to my surprise, there was a female voice asked, you know, what I wanted, and I said I would like to talk to Ladislav, and the woman started to cry, and after a while said, I'm sorry, he's not with us anymore, he died 3 weeks ago. So by strange synchronicity, this message gave us a telephone number where there happened to be a family that lost a person with the same name. The second very remarkable experience that I had involved a colleague of mine who went to Maine, where he and his family had a summer cabin, and he went scuba diving without a marker, without any companions, and he never came back. He drowned, and his body or the diving equipment had never been recovered. And his wife was also a psychologist, and she had tremendous problems with the integration somehow and acceptance of this death, because he was young, energetic, sort of full of initiative, enthusiasm, and he just went for a little dive before lunch and then he disappeared. And at that time we had an LSD program, which was a training program for professionals, and she qualified, so she decided to have a psychedelic session, hoping that she would get some insights into this situation and that it would help her to reconcile somehow with his death. And I became her sitter. And then in the second half of the session, she suddenly took off her eye shades and told me that her husband appeared to her and that they had a long discussion, kind of a telepathic exchange, talking about particularly their children and the future. They had 3 children, future of the children. And towards the end of this discussion, she asked the question, how do I live now when you're not in my life? And the answer that came was basically, live as if I had never existed, just sort of live it up, you know, you're free. And so she told me about it and was very incredulous. She said, you know, obviously this is wishful thinking on my part, this is exactly what I would like to hear. I just can't believe this. And what happened is that her husband appeared again with a kind of additional message, which was basically he asked her to return a book that he had borrowed from a friend, and he gave us the name of the book, he described the shelf and the order of the book, where the book was, and gave us the name of the friend to whom the book belonged. And we were able to find the book and return it, because it turned out that he actually had borrowed it from that particular friend. So this was a very, very interesting experience. The third one was an experience where we had psychologist who actually was quite conservative, quite skeptical. He had an experience where his dead grandmother appeared, and he had a very, very powerful, very emotional kind of exchange. She was a very important person in his life. During the experience, he obviously doubted that this was an authentic connection, because he had such a close connection emotionally with her, and he thought that he could have easily fabricated this whole thing. So he asked a kind of an inner question, you know, how do I know that it's really you? And the answer was, go to Aunt Anne and look for cut roses. And when he arrived, he found her in the rose garden surrounded by cut roses. And this was the only day in the whole year where she decided to, you know, work on her garden and prune the roses. So this is the kind of evidence, the kind of observations that you make when you work with non-ordinary states, which certainly don't represent a proof of the beyond or the astral realms or the discarnate entities, but at the same time represent very striking kind of similarities, so that we can see how easily some people would see this as an evidence for the existence of the beyond. Then we have in this category of communication with the deceased beings or discarnate entities the interesting observations in the realm of spiritism. Those are kind of instances of quasi-experimental evidence suggestive of survival of consciousness after death. This, of course, is a very highly charged, very controversial area. The spiritistic sciences and the question of mediumship. Again, obviously, there was a lot of fraud in this area. Some of the professional mediums were caught cheating, but at the same time, there were some very, very convincing and very well documented observations which kind of withstood all the tests and gained a very high esteem from careful and reputable researchers. The best media were able to accurately reproduce in their performance the voice of the deceased, the speech patterns, the gestures, the mannerisms, and other characteristic features. Then, on occasion, there were sort of some very specific characteristics of these observations that made the evidence more convincing than other observations. Another example of that are the so-called proxy sittings, where, let's say, when we want to have information about a deceased relative, we don't go to the medium ourselves, but we send somebody who did not know the person about whom we seek information. So these are the so-called proxy sittings that eliminate somehow the possibility that the information that the medium is getting is not from the deceased person, but is from the recipient of the message. Now then we have a particularly interesting new set of observations which come from Raymond Moody and are described in the book Reunions. Now Moody at a certain point became very fascinated by the phenomena of crystal gazing and scrying and some of the lore that talks about seeing apparitions of the deceased people in wells or in other water sources and so on. He was particularly interested in the information about a place in ancient Greece, which was a kind of a system of catacombs where they had a large copper kettle with water, and people came specifically for encounters with their relatives, where they would be gazing into this kettle and the images of their relatives would appear and they could communicate with them. So Moody then at a certain point replicated the situation he created a kind of a theater where a person would sit in an armchair in a little cabin, which is lined with black velvet, and is sitting and looking into a mirror. And according to his reports, the people would then see the visions of their dead relatives. And according to his description, in many instances, it's not just seeing these images in the mirror, but these figures of these dead relatives actually step out of the mirror like holographic images in a three-dimensional form and move around in the room. And he even describes instances where sometimes these three-dimensional visions continue happening in people's everyday life outside of this experimental situation. There are many very interesting phenomena that have been observed in the context of the spiritistic church, particularly in Brazil and in the Philippines, where there are healers who, supposedly under the influence of deceased entities, are able to not only diagnose but also treat diseases, including, you know, major surgical operations conducted typically without anesthesia, without anesthetics, and without stitching. Also, the surgeries of the psychic surgeons within the Spiritist Church have been witnessed and even studied and filmed by Western researchers, quite a few of them of good professional standing, like Walter Pankey, Stanley Krippner, and Andrea Buharich. And at the end of this category, I would like to mention a phenomenon that is very, very fantastic, and that I'm still sort of struggling with myself, although I consider myself fairly open-minded in these areas. This is a phenomenon which is called instrumental transcommunication, and that's TRANS, transcommunication, or ITC. This has a very interesting history. Several decades ago, there was a Scandinavian researcher, Friedrich Jurgensen, who was interested in studying the songs of birds, and he did some recordings in a quiet forest. And he came back, and when he was listening to the recording, he found out that in between the songs of these birds, there were voices. And after he had done a lot of study of these human voices, he concluded that those had to be voices from the beyond. And so he reported this, and it was picked up by psychologists from one of the Baltic republics, Konstantin Raudive, who spent a good part of his professional life on this phenomenon, and recorded over 100,000 multilingual paranormal voices that allegedly were communicating messages from the beyond. And he published a book called Breakthrough, which had a little long-playing record giving examples of these voices, including the voice of Churchill. Now then, for a few decades, nothing happens in this area, and now this all came back with vengeance. There are now several hundreds of researchers in the United States and in Europe who claim that they are receiving messages from the beyond on various forms of electronic equipment. It seems to be important here that the electronic equipment typically are using transistors. The principle of functioning of transistors is that they're based on probabilities, on the so-called tunneling effect and so on. So there is a kind of a probabilistic, quantum relativistic medium there, and they see that as the ideal interface for the communication between the world of consciousness and matter. The reason that matter is not present there in a concrete form, but just in a potential form. So they are now getting supposedly files in their computers which bring messages from the beyond, or they're getting pictures on the television screen, or they're getting telephone messages in their message machines. What is interesting, that these people claim that now both Friedrich Jurgensen and Raudive, who had both died in the meantime, are now operating on the other side, and they're trying to communicate with our level. And they have now a discarnate entity who calls himself the technician, who is designing somehow the ideal circuits for the gadgets for ideal communication with the beyond. The research of the psychological, philosophical, and spiritual aspects of death and dying that we have discussed has considerable theoretical and practical implications. Obviously, these experiences don't represent a kind of unequivocal proof of survival of consciousness after death or of the existence of astral realms inhabited by discarnate beings, or proof for reincarnation of the individual unit of consciousness and continuation of the physical existence in another lifetime. It is possible to imagine some other types of interpretation of the data. There are some researchers who try to attribute some of this to kind of extraordinary and amazing paranormal capacities of human consciousness, which they describe super psi, where actually this would be access to information in the psyche of the researchers rather than something coming from some sources outside of them. But one thing seems very clear, that none of the interpretations of these facts that are based on careful analysis of the data that we have discussed are really compatible with what Fritjof Capra called the Newtonian-Cartesian paradigm of Western materialistic science. So whatever interpretations and explanations we come up with will certainly be done in a conceptual framework radically different from the one that we now have in traditional science. Now, besides this theoretical relevance, some of the issues that we talked about have also great practical significance. They have considerable importance for psychiatry, for psychology, and psychotherapy. For example, I have described in some previous books the importance of experiences of encounter with death as a source of various emotional and psychosomatic disorders, which is something that current psychiatry doesn't acknowledge, that if we experience situations like near drowning or coming close to death during whooping cough or pneumonia or diphtheria, having long and difficult births where we come close to death, this would be experiences recorded in our unconscious and experiences that can play a very significant role in the development of various emotional and psychosomatic problems. And conversely, reliving of these life-threatening situations can have tremendous healing implications and lead to personality transformation and consciousness evolution. A particularly important phenomenon for psychotherapy is the phenomenon of dying before dying. As a result of these kinds of experiences, we typically lose fear of death, which changes also our experience of dying, because when we come to death, it's not us dying, but we see it as our body dying, and our identity has expanded beyond that into the transpersonal realm. But at the same time, the elimination of the fear of death also transforms the quality of everyday life, the capacity of enjoying life more, having increased zest, feeling deeper connection with other people, with nature, with the universe, having direct access to the spiritual dimension, and being able to be more in the present rather than being driven constantly towards some kind of accomplishment or goal in the future. Now, the kind of concept that we have about death has also tremendous collective implications. For example, whether or not we believe in reincarnation certainly would have very powerful consequences for our behavior, how we treat other people, what we do and what we don't do. Plato said explicitly in Laws, "Believe that all of human existence ends with death would be boon for the wicked." So in a situation that we are facing today, the global crisis, it is really important how we see existence, how we see life, and whether or not we believe that ultimately we have some kind of responsibility for our actions. So we are now facing a situation where the kind of unbridled, insatiable greed and malignant aggression, the existence of weapons of mass destruction, all these things kind of threaten the survival of humanity and possibly life on our planet. And under these circumstances, we should seriously consider any kind of avenue that offers some hope. While this is certainly not a reason or sufficient reason for embracing uncritically the material suggesting survival of consciousness after death, it should be an additional incentive for reviewing the existing data with an open mind and in the spirit of true science. The same applies to the powerful experiential technologies involving non-ordinary states that make it possible to confront the fear of death and facilitate deep positive personality changes and spiritual opening. It is possible that a radical inner transformation and rise to a new level of consciousness is the only real hope that we have in the current global situation. I'd like to say a few words about a very fascinating project that we had when I was working at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center. This was a project of psychedelic therapy with terminal cancer patients, an effort to ease their emotional and physical suffering, eliminate fear of death, and transform the experience of dying itself. We have talked quite a bit about the fact that the situation in relation to death has been changing, that there is now much more interest in death and dying than before. We know quite a bit about the psychology of dying and also the experiences that occur during an acute encounter with death. But we still don't really have effective ways of changing somehow the psychological situation of the dying person. And in this sense, the data that we accumulated in this psychedelic research study with cancer patients, I think, is of great interest. This study was inspired by a number of kind of independent reports about the possibility of easing the suffering of cancer patients. One of them was a suggestion that came from Aldous Huxley, who experienced both mescaline and LSD, and in his correspondence was Humphrey Osmond, who was this early pioneer, psychedelic pioneer. He suggested about 10 different ways of how psychedelics could be used, and one of them was using it in terminal cancer patients in order to raise this most biological of experiences to the level of spirituality. The second independent suggestion came from Dr. Eric Kast, who was an anesthesiologist who was studying effect of different drugs in his medical department in Chicago. And he was testing different narcotics, dilaudid, meperidine, morphine, and so on. And as he was doing this study, somebody told him that when you take LSD, something happens to your perception of pain. And so he included LSD in this double-blind study, and he found out that LSD had superior effect on pain as an analgesic in comparison with dilaudid and meperidol, which were two powerful opiates. But as a side observation, he found out that some of these patients also lost fear of death, which he interpreted as, in psychoanalytic terms, as a regression to infantile omnipotence and primary narcissism and kind of denial, but at the same time concluded that even if it's a delusional kind of development, maybe in a situation where we are facing death, even that is something that is recommendable. Another independent suggestion came actually from Valentina Pavlovna Wasson, who was the wife of Gordon Wasson. They together made several trips to Mexico in the search of psychedelic mushrooms that they had read about in the reports of the conquistadores, and particularly the priests accompanying them, and finally were admitted to a Mazatec mushroom ceremony by Maria Sabina, who was a curandera. And they had powerful experiences, and Valentina Pavlovna concluded that this would be something that could ease the suffering of cancer patients and help them to face the transition at death. I myself discovered this when I was doing work with neurotic patients. I worked with a couple of patients who suffered from thanatophobia, a pathological fear of death. And after they had powerful death rebirth experiences, they told me that their fear of death was eliminated and that their attitude towards death was drastically changed. When I heard it, I wondered if something similar would happen in people who actually are facing the possibility of death, because these patients were healthy and young, so it was easy to imagine that they lose fear of death. But I ran the sessions with several cancer patients, and I found out that the same happened with them. I wanted to start a study with cancer patients in Prague, but at that time my application for a scholarship to the United States came through, and this was too tempting, so I decided to postpone my plans, and I went to the United States to work with the group at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center. And to my surprise, when I came to the first staff meeting, it was all about using psychedelics in cancer patients. And the way they came to this conclusion was that they were doing a large study working with alcoholics, and they found out that LSD most readily removed or alleviated two particular symptoms. One was anxiety and one was depression. And as they were doing this, one woman, staff member, developed cancer of the breast, and it was discovered very late. It was metastasized. And as a result, she became extremely anxious and very depressed. And as they were talking about it, they said that maybe it would be worth trying if her anxiety or fear and her depression could be influenced in the same way in which it was the case with alcoholic patients, although this was clearly reactive depression. She had a good reason to be depressed. And so Sid Wolf, one of the therapists there, ran a session with her, and the result was so impressive, you know, such a success, that now in the meeting, which was my first meeting with them, the whole meeting was about the possibility of doing work with cancer patients. At that time, Walter Pankey was a member of the team who had a medical background, also background in theology and psychology. He was a very energetic person, and he was the one who put his energy behind it, and he got the money for this research project. The money came from Mary Reynolds Babcock Foundation, which was Winston-Salem cigarette money, which was quite interesting. Now, we started this large study, which was a cooperation between the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center and the Sinai State Hospital, in particular the oncological unit of Sinai State Hospital. And Walter and I were the two physicians supervising the study. We spent one day doing the grand rounds with the oncologists, seeing the patients, and when they had a patient where they didn't have anything more to offer medically, maybe short of a hypophysectomy or something really heroic, they allowed us to see the patient and suggest the psychedelic treatment. The objective here was twofold. One was influencing the emotional condition of these cancer patients, including the fear of death and the attitude towards dying. The other one was the influence on pain. As some of the previous studies showed, even pain that didn't respond to narcotics could be frequently positively influenced by LSD, not just for the time of the pharmacological effect of the drug, but sometimes for the following weeks. So when a patient agreed, you know, we spent about 12 to 15 hours in just regular interviews, going through the life of the patient, trying to find out about the cancer, when it was diagnosed, what the patient was told, how they responded to it, how it changed the situation in the family, and so on. And then we had a special session where we explained somehow the effect of LSD, the types of experiences that the patient could explain. And then after this kind of preparation was completed, then we actually ran the session. The sessions were conducted in very severe cancer patients in their beds in Sinai Hospital, in some of the cases who were not that advanced, we could actually take the patients to our treatment suite at the Psychiatric Research Institute. We were using high dosages between 300 and 600 micrograms. The sessions were internalized. The patients were asked to wear eye shades and headphones, and we played powerful music throughout the session. Ideally, there was very little talking during the session. The talking was done before, and then little coming down from the session, and then particularly the day after the session and in the follow-up. So the emphasis was on internalization of the experience and the inner experience. As the patient was coming down from the experience and all the major issues were resolved internally, we had a kind of a reunion where people of the patient's choice would come, usually spouses, children, you know, other relatives, and we would have a joint dinner. We usually brought some food that had interesting tastes and colors and textures, because these experiences usually open the sensorium very much. And then we had a discussion, which was very, very important, because in this state where the patient was very open, he or she frequently was able to express some things that they were not able to express otherwise. Being very honest, being very upfront, being able to say goodbye, express gratitude, and so on. So those were very, very moving, very important psychological exchanges. Now, the way we were evaluating this study was we were using questionnaires in which the patients and a variety of other people were describing somehow their impressions of the effect of the therapy. So the patient would describe the subjective evaluation. There would be the nurses describing the changes that they saw in the patient, and also the attending physicians. And we also asked the family to give us similar kind of stylized, structured report about the changes they saw from before to after. And then we sort of evaluated this statistically. We found out some really major changes in the patients, where about 40% of the patients were seen as dramatically improved, 30% of patients were moderately improved, and the rest was unchanged. We haven't seen any indications of worsening of the condition of the patients. The changes that we saw, first of all, changes of the emotional condition, lifting of depression, reduction of fear, less tension, better capacity to sleep, and so on. What was particularly interesting, we saw a dramatic alleviation of the fear of death in many of the patients, and also tremendous ability to bring themselves into the present moment, where before they were kind of spending a lot of time ruminating about the past and having fearful fantasies about the future, how it's going to be when things get worse, and so on. Here they were able to bring themselves much more into the present moment and live sort of one day at a time and really sort of appreciate fully what life had to offer and what they still were able to do. There was also very, very dramatic impact on pain. Again, we saw repeatedly reduction or even complete elimination of pain that previously had not responded to the treatment by narcotics. Then the effect of this treatment actually transcended somehow the inner world of the patient and extended into the family. Very frequently, the entire climate in the family was positively influenced. So this study has shown that there's very much that we can do to help somehow people to face the transition when they are suffering from terminal disease. And it's very unfortunate that in spite of the positive results, the political situation that developed in relation to the use of psychedelics prevented the continuation of this project and passing this information to other places so that this kind of procedure could be used on a very large scale. We started this discussion of the psychological, philosophical, and spiritual aspects of death and dying by comparing the situation of a person dying in one of the ancient or pre-industrial societies was the situation of an average Westerner, and we showed the advantages that a person has in one of these pre-industrial cultures. Now, the modern consciousness research has shown that many of the elements that make dying easier can really be put on a very solid theoretical basis using the observations and the experiences from modern consciousness research. And we hopefully in the future will be able to find a situation where we will be able to use some of the best of the ancient wisdom and modern science and create a really comprehensive approach to dying that would make this most difficult situation of human life much more acceptable and raise it, as Huxley said, somehow to the level of a powerful spiritual experience.
This concludes tape 4. Our program continues with tape 5.